Well, we're in chapter 4 in Galatians, and it's, you know, he's just really continuing his argument that, well, it's kind of hard to say when it started because it starts at the very beginning, but most of chapter 1 and chapter 2 are prefaces to the argument in the sense of laying a foundation for why he has the authority to make this presentation about the gospel and the basis of the gospel. And then in the beginning of chapter 3, the argument about the gospel that it's not works, it's faith that is the basis, the foundations for righteousness, is an argument from experience saying, you know, this is what you did do. Argument from Abraham, argument from the law. And then last week we were that kind of continuation of the law as he dealt with that issue back and forth about faith and the law. Chapter 4 is a continuation of that. And last week we noticed there was an introduction to this idea of a tutor, which isn't necessarily what we think of as a tutor. Sometimes it says guardians in some translations. Once again, guardians isn't necessarily often terms we have. There's probably not just a perfect word, but it was somebody that was in charge of kids. But not so much as you might think of, you know, just somebody that's trying to help them learn. There was a broad sense of being in charge, and there was, you know, an authority there in the way they raised them or the way they dealt with them. So in chapter 4, he begins this part, this transition. He says, "Now I say, as long as the heir is a child." And so, really, there hadn't been any reference talking about any heirs. There has been a reference to inheritance in the sense of a promise. Not so much using the word inheritance, but that there's this promise from Abraham. But in verse 29, it says, "And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants, heirs according to the promise." That is, there was this promise made to Abraham that through his seed, and Paul makes the distinction that it doesn't say seeds, plural, it's seed. And through his seed, which is Jesus Christ, through that extension coming to Christ, that the world will be blessed. And that Jesus is the Messiah, is the Christ, and his death has brought about the, if not real, the potential blessing to the whole world. And so here he talks about, if you belong to Christ, then you're in that position to inherit this promise. So that's the first really reference to heirs. And so now following up on that concept, he says, "Now say to you, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he is owner of everything." Now, the concept, you know, is a little different from our settings, but yet in some ways would be similar. But here, you know, this heir had a tutor or guardian over him. And the way the guardian would have treated the heir and a slave, if he had a both in his, you know, in his tutelage here, wouldn't necessarily be any different. And you could think of that in some extensions, you know, as examples. I don't know that I don't think they'd be a one-to-one kind of thing, but you could think of kids in, you know, a Sunday school class. Well, one may be, you know, maybe the grandson of Sam Walton, and one day is going to receive all this. The other, you know, may just, you know, be my grandson that's going to be hoping they don't inherit, you know, bills. But in that Sunday school class, you know, they're just 5 years old, 5 year olds. They're being treated the same. That's kind of what this is looking at, that there's not a difference at that point. And he's saying that to make a further illustration, or to make an illustration. He says, "But he's under guardians and managers until the date set by the Father." So if you have a will that leaves, you know, whatever, your inheritance to your children, you know, I don't think, you know, Penny would be in that situation now. I don't think any of the rest of us are in it. Where though you're talking about minor children, then they, you know, it may be, let's say, it's all set up where they inherit everything. But you're probably not going to let them inherit everything at 10 years old. You're probably going to put a guardianship there, an executor of that will that's going to handle that trust until a certain age. And I know when I was in seminary, Megan was born in seminary while we were in seminary, and then so we had a will drafted at that time, and you know everything went to our children, which was only Megan at that time, which there wasn't, you know, about the only thing she would have received at that time was a few seminary books, and I don't think we had anything else anyway. But nevertheless, that was the case. I guess we did take out, I got a life insurance policy at that time also, so. And it was, the will was drafted that, you know, there would be, you know, some guardian executor over that until she was 18. Well, that was kind of early, you know, in that part of, I think she was born, let's see, the end of my third year. And so at the end of seminary, that summer, you know, a year later, I was working for a law firm after I was out of seminary, that the just running errands for them, and this one attorney somehow was asking me about my will and stuff, and he wanted to look at it, and he wrote a codicil to it to change it. And he was, you know, one of the questions he was asking, he said, "Do you really want your kids to get all this when they're 18?" And you know, so you know, it was changed to 21, and now I would change it to later myself if I was doing it over again. You know, I think I'd put stipulations in it until, you know, when you graduate and all that. But nevertheless, from college or something, when you're 25, or, you know. But the point is that technically, theoretically, you know, or potentially, that inheritance is yours. But you're not going to receive it until a certain time. Now, talking about wills, we're talking about a death. But so if you set it out in some other sense, it still would be the same concept that this is yours, but it's not yours to actually possess until a certain date. And that's what Paul is illustrating with this idea of an heir and guardian, that in this time period, there's no difference between the heir to be and a slave. They're both under tutelage. They're both under guardians. They have no access to those provisions at this time. So he continues in verse 3. He says, "So also we." So now we start to see, here comes in the illustration. "So also we, while we were children, were held in bondage under the elemental things of the world." So coming back, we would be in this context of Christians, those that, according to verse 29, belong to Christ. So we, prior to this, were in bondage to the elemental things of the world. But when the fullness of time came, so we start to see that. So when we, actually I should have backed up and said, when we, the Jews, talking about the Jewish history, when we Jews, when we, you know, prior to Christ, you know, even those that would have been associated with Israel, prior to that time, we were under the bondage of the law. But when the fullness of time came, and we see in the context broader, the fullness of time would be when Christ was born, when God sent forth His Son. God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law. So we see the time period. Now, in the sense that Christ is born under the law, not meaning that He was, you know, obligated to the law to attain righteousness, but meaning that, you know, it's not that there was not grace. I mean, if we ever think of it, there's law and grace, and before Christ came, there was no grace, then we just have failed to notice what's going on in the Old Testament with God ever since the very beginning. But in that distinction of the cross, before that, Christ is born under the law. And so he's the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, but he's born of a woman. So we see this unique incarnation, fully God, fully man. Purpose, and he gives two purposes here, or results that came from it, so that he might redeem those under the law. God sent his Son, and the primary purpose stated here is to buy back those who are under the law. And that's the basic idea of redemption, is to purchase out of. So in that context, if you're purchasing out of here, it would be for the sense of release or to restore to a position, to buy back. Secondly, he says that we might receive adoption as sons. Now that is a really phenomenal concept when you start considering that God somehow in his plan would decide to provide salvation, that we would be saved, that we would be redeemed. But it doesn't stop there. It moves on, having been purchased to be made children. I think it's really hard for us to grasp how significant that is, because we've grown up with the concept of being children of God, and we hear that so much, which is appropriate. But if you really thought of it in terms of someone that deserves absolutely nothing, they deserve something, but it's nothing positive. You deserve only what's negative. And God would be so merciful to grant life, life at whatever level, is an incredible grace. And I think it's hard for us to fathom that. It really is. But if we could picture it in terms of that, the only prospect we have is to walk through this door that above it has the title hell. That's the only option we have, as far as what we know. And then somewhere God comes along and says, wait a minute, here's another option. You don't have to go there. And whatever that is, it's got to be better, and we're happy. And we're just like, oh, you mean we can come? We can come, sweep up after dinner. We can come, graze out in your pasture. whatever. It sounds wonderful. We can live in a shack way out back in the North 40. But then he goes, no, you don't have it. You're going to be my son. You're going to be my daughter. You're going to be my child. And that's, so these two purposes here. He might redeem. He might buy back. And you might receive adoption. Reason, because you are sons. Because you are sons. So there we are. The purpose is that it might be bought back. You might have. So we've been adopted. Now, because you are sons, God sent forth His Spirit. Now, the timing of all this doesn't really work in our perspective of timing, because the Spirit was sent before we were born. But in the sense of the cross and the new covenant, it's the inauguration of that new covenant, setting that in place when Christ dies, and the Holy Spirit comes in a different sense at that time into the lives of all believers. He sent forth His Son into our hearts. So there's this experiential sense of the Holy Spirit indwelling us, crying, Abba, Father. The Abba, Father probably doesn't have, some more recent studies have suggested that it doesn't have quite the the extreme intimacy that some that for several years it was kind of told to be, but it still is in that realm. It probably isn't the extreme intimacy that we've heard in the past, but it still is very much in that sense of that closeness. I mean, even the term Father. You know, this was one of the things with Jesus. Referring to God as Father wasn't unknown. But Jesus, you know, probably one of the significant things in the Lord's Prayer, when they say, you know, teach you how to pray, you know, our Father, that sense of possessive, our Father, not the Father, not the Father of Abraham, not the Father of Israel, but our Father. And so this is even more intimate than that. And so there's something inside us now that, you know, the Spirit of God inside us, that causes us to cry out, Abba, Father, that recognition, that intimacy, that's placed within us. That is not natural to fallen man. The thing that's natural to fallen man, according to Romans, is to run away from God. Not to seek after God, to go in the other direction. But all of a sudden now there's something drawing us. Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but a son. That's the different standing. So in Paul's terminology, prior to the cross, everyone was a slave to the law. But now, you're a son. And as a result of that, an heir through God. So if we're a son, and you're back to the part in verse 29 of chapter 3, if you belong to Christ, then you're heirs according to the promise, that if we're not a slave, then you're a son. The two options are very simple in theology. You know, you're either a slave to the law, or you're an heir of Christ. Biblical theology doesn't place a third category there. However, at that time, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those which by nature are not gods. So, in a practical sense, on the horizontal level, what is it that we're slaves to? Well, people are slaves to the things that control them. In this sense, it was various things and throughout much of this type of history and within this various world, there were various idols that were worshipped. Israel itself was really not caught up into idol worship after the captivity. You know, when they were restored, idol worship was not a major issue with Israel after that. But it very clearly isn't in the world they live in now. But even in our sense, where you don't have idols we worship, you know, what is it that people tend to serve? And it says, you were slaves, but by nature they're really not God. But now that you have come to know God, and you got to love this, or rather to be known by God. See, you know, everything from our perspective is we seek God. I mean, if I tell you my testimony, it is how I saw how I was caught up into various evil things, and I changed, and I began to seek after God. I mean, that's all I know in my experience is I sought after God. I remember calling a friend that I knew was a Christian, had been my roommate and before, and you know, we talked and got involved. I mean, it was a pursuit after God. Yet Romans says you don't pursue God by ourselves. And so here it says, you have come to know God. No, well, really, technically what happened, God got to know you. So our perspective is that we come to know God, but the only reason we come to know God is that God knows us. And there lies this mystery that we're never, in my opinion, we're never going to be able to mesh together in a perfect sense. It's just two things that are true, and how they mesh together is, for the most part, a little beyond us. But we were known by God. How is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again? And that comes, you know, there we are, kind of the really crunch part, difficult part of the Christian life. Why do we move back to the things that enslaved us? Well, you know, we have this path to walk that's in righteousness God has laid out for us, and yet we find ourselves from time to time walking this path back to where we used to live. You know, it's almost as though you know, if you use the old, really old stereotypes of, you don't hear that phrase often anymore, maybe because we just don't have railroad tracks the way we used to, but, you know, you lived on the wrong side of the tracks. And you know, and a lot, if you go through a lot of small towns, you know, where there's a railroad track or used to be a railroad track, you know, you can still see kind of how the way the highway and everything was laid out, and especially I know in West Texas, a lot of the towns lay on one side of the railroad track, because to be on the other side of the railroad track, it's cut off because you got this railroad track and get across it, and so the town and the highway is all laid out on one side. But there is, you know, a few houses and things on their side. So that became, for small towns at least, you know, the slums or whatever, if you want to use that term. But if you can kind of use that image, that's where we're from. But now we live on this side. We have a new house. We have, you know, this mansion. And yet we're driving down the road, and from time to time it's as though, and I'm sure you've driven that way if you go to work on a certain way and whatever, when you're doing something else, and if you find yourself thinking about other things, you just automatically turn, and about a minute later you go, I didn't want to go there. And you just do these things almost out of habit. Well, it's almost like that. You know, we just kind of veer over. We go back to the other place. And that's what Paul is saying here. If you're a child, if you have the Holy Spirit, if you're really adopted, if, then why? How is it that you turn back? And that's really what this group has done. They've moved back under the law. It's not so much here that they've gone back to doing evil things, if you would, in the sense of morality evil, but they've moved back into saying, this is how we're spiritual. Is if we do this and do this and do this, if we serve the law. And actually what they've done is moved back into a standard of, that's what life was as a slave. That's not where you're supposed to be. He goes on to say this, you know, to give us a little more clue. He says, you observe days and months and seasons and years. Now, we observe, you know, we're going to observe Easter and we observe Palm Sunday. I mean, it's not that there's not something to observe. But if we look at Easter Sunday and activities or attendance as the way to grace, the way to attainment, the status of spirituality, then that would be what he's talking about here. You've moved back into that type of criteria. And he says, I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. That the ministry with you has really just been empty because you've just returned to where you are. And, you know, one of the things you look through here, you say, well, what is, you know, based on this, what is a Christian? Well, a Christian in 3:29 to be one that, you know, has inherited something about the promise, one that belongs to Christ. In verse 5, a Christian is one that's been redeemed, one that is a son. A Christian is one that is not under the law. is not a slave. Well, then you go, well, how do you live the Christian life? Well, this passage may not tell us as much about how to live it in this point, but it's very clear on what not to do. You don't live it by returning to being a slave. That you live it as being a son. And there comes, you know, where we are. There's different terminology, but a lot of similarity here between what he writes here in Romans 7, where we had this same thing about being a slave to the law or being free in Christ. You know, there is, in one sense, you're going to make a choice. Who are you going to be slave to? You're going to be slave to the law? Or there it's really your sin nature. You're going to be slave to your old sin nature? You're going to be a slave to the new nature or righteousness? And so that's where Paul is moving here in this argument about the gospel and the law and faith. He looks back and he says, what you used to be is a slave, but what you are now is a son. And the law, even though he hadn't talked about faith in this part, he's laid it out in the sense of the law, it continues to have that sense of being inadequate. The law had a different purpose. The law was before Christ, before the fullness of time. And Christ has come to bring a different deliverance. The law cannot do that. Any thoughts or questions, insights? Yeah. I don't know. Galen, if you've talked to Galen, his real turning point in his life was teaching Sunday school class on Galatians. And the commentary he was using for the class was Warren Wisby, which is evangelical. And as he's teaching this class, this idea of grace just came alive. I knew a guy, he was a graduate of Dallas Seminary, and he pastored a church that was 50, 60, 70 miles from Brenham, but it truly was a community church. I mean, there really wasn't a town. I mean, there's no town. There was the church and a couple of stores or something, but I mean, it's just a little, it draws from this rural community. And being a community church in that setting, it was, if you lived out there and you wanted to go to church, you didn't want to drive, 50 miles, that's where you went to church. So there were all kinds of people. And it was for the setting, it was really kind of unique, pretty good-sized church and so forth. And I remember him saying in a meeting once that he started Galatians. And by the end of Galatians, the church was half the size. It touched, for evangelicals, I agree, we end up, I think there's some safeguards about being careful, but for the most part, we're talking about somebody else. I find there are a lot of safeguards in here because you kind of get these reminders because we have those tendencies to put, this is the mark of spirituality. we can get them very easily without thinking about it. But, it's mainly that other element that is going to put something up as being spiritual. This is the standard. And what Paul is saying is you're moving under a sense of slavery. But that group will not see it as slavery. They see it as whatever, dedication, as, zealousness. But Paul... And that's his approach with these people. And so when you think about it, here's a group that's bought into it, and you look at his argument, it's so intriguing. Because his argument says, here's this, heirs and slaves, and they're together. And you go, okay, yeah, I understand that. And all of a sudden it's like, that was really being a slave, and now here's the son, and what do you want to be? And, it's a very very ingenious type of presentation. Other thoughts? Well, my answer will probably be totally off the wall then. That's an interesting one. I don't know. And I remember when I read that and heard that, and then you kind of look through it, and you don't, and you go, well, you don't really hear about it. And was it there, and we just don't hear about it? That's a definite possibility. But it's not. Evidently, it wasn't a major thing, because that's not what we see in the prophets, the minor prophets. So, was it there? I wouldn't doubt that. But it evidently wasn't the controlling thing. It's not what God's addressed. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, if you want to just kind of guess or postulate, maybe in that times were always tough after that. And one of the things which it seems to be so ironic is that in difficult times, we recognize that most of us have a tendency to depend on God. And when times aren't difficult, we may not as much. I don't know if that's part of it. I don't know if it's having been around the pagan system as much as they were, that there was a real sense of renewal and returning to their heritage. And so during that time period, that was a real draw. If it's a combination of those things, if there wasn't the powerful leaders, the kings that were trying to, trying to pursue their own agenda, that's one of the things, with our representation that we have as a nation, I heard this today, and you just have to wonder so often if that's not what it's all about is. Once you get elected, everything after that is about staying elected. It has nothing to do about being a representative, a servant. It's just about maintaining power. Well, the leadership after that was different. You didn't have kings. You didn't have a sovereign nation. And so maybe, I don't know if it's one thing, but maybe those variety of things. Because we did see, as we're looking at kings right now, that as the king went, there went the nation. And so part of that, I think you have that. But I don't know. I mean, a sense of an answer or a definite thing, we don't see it. Yes. A little more sense of... And they did it, they had problems, they had issues, and they weren't like, God clobbers them, and like Malachi's, shut the doors of the temple, if you're going to act this way. And it's not like they were just all zealous for God, but I think as a group or as a nation, if you can call them a nation at that point, since they weren't sovereign, they weren't the privileged group anymore. And maybe that draws them. Kind of like, they talk about the church in China. When it was forced underground, it just, I guess there's always been, it was incredible growth. And so there was a lot more sense of starting the persecution in that. So I don't know. If, maybe just a variety of those kind of reasons. I'm not sure. All right. Are there prayer requests?